to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
It's my distinct honor and privilege to moderate tonight's conversation with two of the authors of the Clue Train Manifesto, David Weinberger and Doc Searles, and among all of you, for which it's an incredible brain trust in the room. I'm eager to open it up as quickly as possible. Let's say something. How many people have read the Clue Train Manifesto? Wow. Now, maybe I should stop for a moment and define read. There's a kind of read that is the back of the book, and kind of flipping through and then maybe looking at the Wikipedia page or read a review of the book. How many people have done that, at least? Okay. How many people have actually read the book the way we meant read in the 20th century? All right. Still a lot of people, for those of you in cyberland, that say they've done it, so it's going to be a very in-depth conversation. But for those who haven't, help us out. First, paint the scene. 10 years ago, what did it look like as you were gathering together to actually pen a manifesto raging with, I don't know, cocaine-fueled late-night in the writer's room?
Present company accepted.
Against what were you raging? What was the situation 10 years ago?
I think that the main thing, at least for me, was that the net was not well understood. That the net, and I think the net is still, to some degrees, not understood, or you wouldn't have written your book, you know, the future of the internet and how to stop it. So there's, that's still there. There's some misunderstanding of the net. There's parts of it that I don't think we fully knew even what we were saying, even though we said it. So for example, not long after the book came out, I was on a little show on an old TV network that's now gone with Jacob Nielsen, and afterwards he said, "Well, you know, you guys were marketers who defected from marketing and sided with markets against marketing," and pointed out that we were using the second person voice against marketing, basically against the machine, as it were. We were saying you this and you that,
and in fact, even Clue Train, like you don't have a clue, is a sort of, there's a kind of element of smugness to it, right?
Yeah, well, we were siding with buyers. We were siding with citizens. We were siding with society, with individuals, and for that matter, with companies that weren't necessarily that well funded. And we actually felt there was the line that galvanized it for me, and I it probably did for David as well, was one that Chris Locke sent out. It was a little GIF that said, "We are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings, and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it." And I didn't even realize until later, when Jacob pointed that out, that, you know, who is the we we're talking about? You know, who is it that our reach is exceeding your grasp? Who are we? Who are you? And we were ordinary folks, and you were the people misunderstanding us, mm-hmm. and misunderstanding the net as well. And we felt that the net had enormous potential beyond just IPO scores. And that's basically what the play was for at the time. So I think, to answer your question, the crash took care of some of that, and the net has in fact completely changed a great many things. Where I don't think any of us would give it up at this point. I think that there, I mean, if you were to, you know, take any one of us from even 10 years ago, or maybe 15 years ago, and put us in now, we would say this is kind of utopian. Hmm. You know, we have a lot more. You know, we're getting the net on our phones. We're getting it, you know, through data cards. It is relatively ubiquitous. It is highly available in a lot of places. It now is undermining the phone system. The phone companies that we hated are kind of blowing up. Their institutions we liked, like newspapers, that are kind of collapsing. We're seeing some consequences there. But it's terribly disruptive, and goodly disruptive too, I suppose.
And I guess part of dividing the world a little bit into them and us, with the us and the we, the people, being the former little guy that had been perceived by those in power as mere eyeballs or
right.
things that could be easily manipulated. Now the sheep are standing and they're not wanting to be shorn anymore. how does this fit into your view about authenticity? That somehow there's something real about
this is voice. It's the voice point.
I know.
David's groaning.
Oh no, this is one of the things I think we were wrong about.
So
thanks a lot.
Yeah. I believe you mean that sincerely. So tell us.
No, I do actually mean it.
Yeah.
I still think that the web is disruptive, exceptionally so. It's not simply another communications medium, that this is the age of the web, and that I still think it's as important as the age of the printing press. I mean, I think it's epically important. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's one of the premises of Clue Train, is this is really, really important. There is this element of anger that you're pointing at, and I think this is one of the, I'm going to get to your point in a second. I think this is one of the ways in which the Clue Train is dated. The tone of it is now angry middle-aged men who feel released from their upbringing, which was dominated by broadcast, and it's oppressive. Broadcast was an oppressive regime. Today's youth, the digital natives or whatever, don't have that. It's not an act of liberation to step into the internet. It's simply what is. So the angry tone of obnoxious angry tone of and smug tone of Clue Train, which was very effective for it at the time, apparently, I think is now out of date. I don't think we would write it the same way anymore. The problem with authenticity is this is a really, really hard point. And Chris used to say, I suppose still does, that corporations can't be authentic because I'll channel Chris Locke Rageboy, because they can't fuck. They don't have bodies. They're not real things. And I think there is a strong element of truth.
Your anti-Unix screed must have gone over well. Not to be confused with the plural Unix.
Yes, of course. All right. And this is one of the, so we sometimes, Doc and I sometimes are approached by happy, excited marketing people who say, oh, you co-wrote Clue Train, I love that book, it's so important to me, and then they tell us what they're doing as marketers, and the blood drains from our face, oh my God,
This is like that cartoon, Becca, do you have the cartoon up?
Yes, it is like that cartoon.
At the social media for marketers, how about if I deceive people authentically, transparently, and passionately?
Yes.
Yeah. Sincerity is the most important thing. If you can fake that, you've got it made.
So I want to say two things, both brief and contradictory. First is that the notion of authenticity is extremely difficult and dangerous. It's difficult because corporations aren't people. It's dangerous because it can be used to make you feel good about what you're doing in your without it having any substance. So there's a certain danger to authenticity. But the authenticity also does capture something that we do want to capture when we talk about companies or people, which is there are times when we want to say about somebody that she or he or the company itself is completely inauthentic. They're lying, they're self-deceptive, or whatever it is. It's a useful term, but there isn't a lot of metaphysics behind it when you start pulling it apart. So it makes me very nervous to hear authenticity raised, because it is an important value in the Clue Train Manifesto, because I now think it's mainly just this sort of grab bag of stuff that doesn't resolve into anything real. And so it makes me nervous.
I don't agree. I think that the what we said about voice, and that was all David and Chris, I should say, and possibly Chris especially, because he has such a distinctive one. To a large extent, the tone of Clue Train is Chris's tone.
Yeah.
I think we're experimenting with that right now. I think what's happening with Twitter here. I think what's happening with what's been happening with blogs since Clue Train came out, what's been happening with the web in general, is with texting for that matter. I think that, and I don't know if it's authenticity, it's human, it's part of, and the net is inherently, a human place.
So let's take Twitter as a case study.
So I agree with all that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask
Sure.
Yeah.
So what's Procter & Gamble's authentic voice? I mean, that's the thing that
here's what I think. I mean, I think there is a place in the world for things that only big companies can do. And I think that Procter & Gamble makes stuff that other companies can't make. I think what Peter Drucker said, 50, 60 years ago about in the long run, companies will exist at the grace of their employees and their customers, and that the customer will come to the center of the corporate stage is still inevitable and hasn't quite happened. I think a lot of what we were saying, what you said about Fort Business, which is, I think, one of the strongest things in the book, is true. I mean, I think what, you know, that Fort Business will be is an obsolete conceit of an old regime that cannot survive in a world where everybody's connected and communicating.
And just for those who haven't read the book, Fort Business. This is
Fort
a,
Business.
What's the luggage at the other end of that handle?
So it's my handle. I'll do
it's
the
his
luggage.
Handle.
The idea is businesses that confuse themselves, building a business is building a fort, where the walls of the fort are intended to keep information away from customers. So the technique, and markets in general, so the technique that companies traditionally have used is they were the best and sometimes the only source of information about their products and their services. So they would collectively release information in order to control their partners, their customers, their employees. In the age of the net, the walls are a mere mockery because we're all in touch and there are basically no secrets.
So you think you can't really cultivate a brand separate from the truth?
Well, that's another thing that's wrong in the
It's like I thought Morningstar Farms was rolling hills and like, you know, fake pigs walking around from which you make the fake bacon, right? That's how it happens.
It's not?
I don't know.
And California cows can talk.
Thesis number 70-something is forget about advertising. It just doesn't work anymore.
74. Advertising. Forget about it. It doesn't
it's
work.
So totally wrong.
But by
totally
advertising, maybe you just meant blatting out of a megaphone
that works
to
really
a stadium
well.
Full of people.
Right.
But if by advertising what you, the counterpart, the replacement, advertising 2.0 is the much more insidious cultivated authenticity of the blogger who gets sent free equipment in an expectation that he'll review it or something.
But they still get exposed, you know?
We don't know that they do, though. It doesn't matter, really.
If you sell out that cheap, so what? You know, or live with that. I mean, that doesn't concern me. What happens to companies does. I mean, companies now have to live in a world where there's zero distance from everybody. In fact, we all live in a world where if we're on the net, we're all zero distance apart. And the cost of being able to communicate is very, very low. Mm-hmm. And that makes all the difference. There's a high cost to keeping information away from customers. There's a high cost even to keeping information away from competitors, because you can improve your market by revealing information off to competitors. And we're just beginning to learn there's some stuff that does need to be trade secrets. Some of them do have to be kept out. You know,
publicly held company can't just its thoughts in a live stream.
No, but I'm not sure it does all that harm if they do.
Actually, there's an eBay blogger who does more or less. That's fine. There are things that companies need to, by law, or in fact, actually need to keep secret, and we have no problem with that. And we're both totally opposed. I'm going to speak for you, not to the astroturfing and the suborning of bloggers. That's just evil. That's subverting the most valuable social interaction we have, which is talking with one another. So you shouldn't do that, and if you do, you should rot in hell. You know.
That's the title of the sequel.
The problem with advertising is that there is a type of blaring advertisement that blares over the megaphone at the football game that appeals to the lizard portion of your brain and absolutely works. Branding works in the sense that most of us still tend to think of the Toyota Yaris as a young person's car, because that's what I still carry around jingles that I heard when I was 5 years old in 1955, and there's not a medical procedure to get them out. So this stuff
I
does
find that
work.
Pinball Wizard trumps all. It's amazing. You can use that.
I can sing the Eastern Airlines jingle. You know, that stuff does work, but we now have
I'm trying
the
to remember it now.
By Eastern, number one to the sun.
Wow. I remember Northwest.
The intervals are all wrong, but the general progression is correct. But we now have, and this
few
is what...
people know David was originally a musician.
And Kluchang was right about this. He was deeply wrong about some other things as well, though, but it was deeply right that we do now have, as a market and as a culture, the ability to undo some of the damage that the mindless lizard brain advertising does to us, and we can fact check instantly. And when they show, when we're thinking about getting a Mini Cooper because it's going to be so much fun to drive, but we're worried about Boston weather, we are not, this is Ford business. So in the old days, you had to rely upon a dealer, maybe a magazine if you could find one, to tell you. Now, you're the last person you ask is the dealer. How's this baby do on the, in snow? The dealer's always going to say, oh, yeah, my wife drives one. All winter long, it's great. Pardon me for the sexism. So now you're not going to do that.
It's the dealer's sexism.
Well, absolutely. So now you're going to go on the web, and you're going to find out instantly from people in Boston that it does or it doesn't. So
and from there, you're happy if that's from TripAdvisor or from Car Talk or whatever your favorite forum is, or maybe there's even an Amazon review of the car or something.
Yes.
Any and all.
Any and all, yeah.
Got it. Now, you had had a hook almost into the VRM stuff, and I want to do a quick riff on that, but before that...
Yeah.
I want to see Twitter as a quick case study because it is so much the flavor of the month right now.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see the Clue Train principles applied to it. Is Twitter exactly what you were talking about, empowering the little guy in the immortal words of David Weinberger, on the internet, everybody will be famous for 15 people.
Yeah,
at least there's some people who want to tune in to what you're saying, and they can do that, and then they can retweet, and they can retweet, and, you know, stuff rises to the top. Or is it exactly the kind of modality that can be subverted by the forces against which you rail, and there are such things now as Twitter brand managers that can tweet for you? Or there's, what's it called, Twitter lead or something, where you can pile up your tweets for the coming day and have them, you know, burped out at regular intervals.
Random.
I mean, how would you parse it?
I would say yes and no. I think it's very much Clue Train-esque in the sense that everybody can participate, everybody has a voice, you can tell that the voices are authentic. Lots of invention, lots of unpredictability, you know, the hyperlinks subvert hierarchy, which is one of David's lines. It was one of the theses in there. Where it's not is that it's a silo. To some degree, it's a silo. One company is in the middle of it. One company is staying in the middle of it.
A company with no apparent business model, is that true?
So far. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure getting continuous investment is not a business model. I think it is a business model.
Not so much for the investors, but
volume is how they really
exactly. Like,
yeah.
First Interstate Bank, we make change. You know? How do you make money? With volume, right? More change. You know, we just had that happen, didn't we? I suppose. There was a story that was told in the first edition of Clue Train, and in the second one as well. That was pretty revealing. I was at this party, and there was a young guy who was on his third startup, and I recognized him, and I said, what are you doing? And he says, well, we're an arms merchant to the portals industry. And I said, well, there's a portals industry? That's an industry? He said, oh, yeah, and we do this and this and this. And it was all buzzwords. And I finally asked him what I thought was a rude question. I said, how are sales? And he said, they're great. We just closed our second round of financing for $25 million. And it was like this light bulb went off. They said, oh, wait a minute. So every company has two markets, one for its goods and services and the other for itself, right? And what happened in the dot-com era is the second overcame the first, right? We had this whole market. There's nothing about selling your company.
Yeah.
So Twitter's operating in that, okay? And it's interesting that, you know, Evan Williams, who runs it, who's one of the founders of it, sold Blogger to Google. What's Google's business model on Blogger? Who knows, you know? So at some point, they'll sell for some money to somebody who's going to make
money
on it.
Sounds an awful lot like a pyramid scheme.
Yeah, it probably is. You know, I mean, everybody would like to have one of those, actually, you know, and get out before it goes weird somehow. I mean, it does perform a service, right? And I think everything, and this is sort of Clue Training too, that everything's a prototype. Still, everything's a prototype. My wife Joyce is sitting over there. Said once, and one of my favorite lines, which is "trees do not grow to the sky," right? This is not a tree. You know, Twitter's not a tree that grows to the sky. It's not even a tree that stands for very long, as we see, because it's being turned off all the time. And Google isn't either. You know, Google is not the end of times, and like Microsoft wasn't before that, and IBM wasn't before that. You know, everything's, you can prototype all kinds of stuff on the net as long as it remains open and generative.
Got it. Yeah.
So,
All right, so let's do a riff on VRM.
Mm.
Vendor relationship management.
Right.
Turning on its head the old style CRM, by which vendors try to treat their consumers as exactly the sheep-like, eyeball-like, little faceless molecules, and then
right.
send them tailored email on their birthdays and
right.
exactly for them. You're saying, no, let the consumers do that to the vendors.
Right. And we don't call them consumers either. We just call them customers.
Yeah.
There was a line we quoted from Jerry Mikulski that he said a consumer is a gullet that lives only to gulp products and crap cash. And that was in the first book, and he corrected me later, saying they're gullets with wallets and eyeballs. That made it in the second version, which is over there in the corner. But one of my new chapter, all four of the authors have a new chapter in the new edition, deals with the subject of VRM, which is what I'm working on as a fellow at the Berkman Center with something called Project VRM. And VRM stands for Vendor Relationship Management. It's the reciprocal of customer relationship management. CRM is what sends you junk mail. CRM is what organizes the call centers that you hate, that when you call them, they're shunting you off to someplace else. They're making bad guesses about what you want. And what we're doing is turning that around, putting the pricing gun in the hands of customers, putting the ability to issue a global preference in the hands of users, being able to change your address once for everybody that you deal with. Basically giving customers control over their interactions with sellers in the marketplace. And it's like everything else on the net, it's early. It's something that we've been working on for 3 years now. The public radio tuner, which Keith Hopper's over there and some other people maybe in the room too for all I know, have been working on. Some VRM stuff is going to be showing up in that. How many people have a public radio tuner on an iPhone? Wow, not bad. You know,
for the record, maybe 40%, right?
Well, we don't know how many.
How many people have an iPhone? I'm just curious. In this crowd, wow, there's probably maybe
everybody that said they had a tuner has an iPhone.
Yeah, everybody has a public radio tuner.
The Venn diagrams are building themselves in my head right now.
Yeah. So the thing is that more and more control is passing into the hands of users. What we want to do is make sure that it's not just intermediators in the middle, where we have the best way of helping you relate. It's rather you have the tools for relating. And it's still early with that, and we outlined that in the chapter.
So let's try some of this wisdom in the realm of politics. Do you think we've seen in the past 10 years some of the canons of the manifesto bear out in the political space?
Yes.
Mm.
More?
We're treating the witnesses friendly. I don't know what your problem is.
Harvard law professors are impossible. Actually, one of the things I'm absolutely proudest about with the book is that Joe Trippi, who managed Howard Dean's campaign, read it and actually was influential on him to some degree. That makes me feel very happy.
And therefore on the Obama campaign, too, I would say.
Well, indirectly. We always thought that the Clue Train was actually about the effect of the web with business as one example, and I think that there are actually a bunch of precepts, whatever, that apply equally to marketing and to politics ever since 1968, I think the book was written, and I can't remember the name of it, that disclosed that in fact politicians were being treated like soap and the campaigns were just like marketing. We know that's the case, right? Politics and marketing have become one of the same thing. So, to the extent to which the net changes the nature of marketing, likewise for politics. So in the case, to not as successfully, because politics is, and government is harder to change than business is, because business will change on almost instantly if they see an opportunity to make money, whereas in politics you're talking about longer standing institutions, everything goes more slowly. Nevertheless, the way I understand the Dean campaign, which I take as the formative one in this space.
And to which you were a senior internet consultant.
I had a very nice title, senior internet advisor, that way overstated my role as a volunteer, but yes. seriously, you know.
You just went door to door.
I did that too, absolutely, yeah. The basic idea of it, as I understand it, was you have a broadcast model in politics. You have a guy at the top who is broadcasting a message down to the troops, and you try to enforce message discipline. This is exactly how marketers talk. The Dean campaign wanted to undo that. You cannot do that by reversing the flow of the many up to the one, because Howard Dean is not going to read the 680,000 emails that we get a day from his supporters. That's how many people had signed up on the site. So the campaign had this breakthrough idea, which I think is really quite wonderful, which is, well, the way you do this, the way you scale it, is by enabling conversations among the base of the pyramid. You do it laterally.
Precincts.
And on the
cohorts.
Net, anybody.
Yeah.
Cohorts based around any set of interests. So they actually set up a social networking site where you could go, you could register, state your interests, form groups. There was pilots for Dean. There were educators for Dean. There was even Howards for Dean.
Yeah. I joined that
Facebook
group for a while.
Howard,
I don't know why.
So the essential idea of peer-to-peer conversation as empowering and important and human and as a way of undoing the pyramidal structure as much as it can be done, that was, you do see that in politics more and more and more. We're coming to take it actually for granted, which is an amazing thing, just an amazing thing.
And would you see that in the presidency right now? Do you think the executive branch of the United States has taken this to heart?
I think they do, actually. I mean, I'm not saying they took Clutrain, but I think they're taking the web ethos to heart. You can see this in lots of areas.
What do you read from the fact that when they had the first policy quasi-wiki up, I think they used Google Moderator, and people could vote stuff up and down. The top three policy priorities were marijuana legalization, the legalization of marijuana, and pot for all.
Yeah.
And so, is that...
What's wrong with that?
Who's right there? Is it that that's actually the top priority?
You referred to the net as near ubiquitous.
Right.
And even though I'm going to look at, for example, Esther Hargitay, who's right there at the moment,
and who at any moment could erupt into a rant about the digital divide.
Or I would look at our good friend Ethan Zuckerman. I actually could look at many people here who are very persuasive and data-based on the point, even more to the point, that no matter how ubiquitous, say, Wi-Fi access becomes, and of course that is becoming more, the range of skills that are required to succeed with it is pretty vast, and that divide is still there, and the globally, it's extremely unevenly distributed as well. So ubiquity is way, way too optimistic for
right.
the term.
Yeah.
Esther, is that okay? Okay.
Okay. It's established. but for politics, which is where what Jay-Z was asking about, I was watching, because I've been an editor for Linux Journal for, this is 96, one way or another, and an interesting thing to me about the Dean campaign is when that was going on, things like voter rolls and stuff like that were very chaotic. They were on many, many different platforms. Most of them are proprietary. A lot of them are like Excel spreadsheets or Fox bases or old DB2 or some other
one
thing.
One of those
like
old VisiCalc.
Well, there's, you know,
oh,
VisiCalc.
Yeah.
VisiCalc.
That crap.
Yeah.
Hi, Dan Brickman, one of the co-creators of VisiCalc.
One of the original VisiCalculators is back there.
More responsible for the internet revolution than perhaps anybody else.
Certainly
you can
the PC
of.
Revolution. Yeah.
So thank you for that, Dan.
We are all prisoners in your cells.
What row and column are you, sir?
A1.
There is a t-shirt for you.
You suck my battleship. Okay, so
the thing is that like Drupal, for example, was young there, but things happened on Drupal in the Dean campaign that got that grew and got routinized, and I think were actually contributed to the growth of Drupal to some degree. But by the time 4 years later that the Obama campaign came around, voter rolls were all unified across the country. There was and it wasn't just because the discipline was imposed from above, though that was partly it. Mm. It was also because there was a diaspora of geeks that came out of the Dean campaign, and they were connected on the net. It was very Clutrain-y in that respect. And the out-of-control nature of that actually served politics very well. Mm. And for a savvy politician like Obama, and he wasn't the only one, there were a lot of others as well, there was an awful lot that could be done both in the command and control way, but with the velvet glove, and also in the grassroots way, giving lots of ways for people to participate, or at least sense they're participating, and certainly give money to.
Yeah.
Now, we should have our medium and our message overlap. It'd be a little weird if we went on too long up at the front about the importance of grassroots participation. So let's start easing in to the brain trust, and
if people want to jump in,
please indicate, and feel free to say what's on your mind, and if you like, say who you are, or draw from all the stuff that's coming in either from you or from outside these walls online in various ways. Sir, tell us who you are. And use the UN-like button.
Yeah, you turn it.
My name is Daniel Dern, and the first question for the Clue Train, I should have sent this email to Chris to ask him as a proxy. Do you feel that the Clue Train, rather than informing the we, was giving dangerous ammunition to the they so that they could do it to us? And by extension, or as a second question, you can pick and choose.
To read the book. It's like Scientology. You can't be trusted.
Well, and the other question is, given in the 2.0 or 3.0 or wherever we are world today with Twitter and social networks, are we hitting the point, a similar point either of co-option or, I'm not sure exactly the phrase, but is there an upper limit that for every company that wants to be my buddy, my friend, my information source, this comes back to the Usenet paradox. I have a limited amount of seconds per day, and I have to decide whether to allocate them, and every time I want to listen to you means I can't do something else there.
In which case, you still want Dan Rather to tell you what car to buy, or somebody who takes his place.
Sadly, at this point, I would rather have John Stewart tell me what to not believe.
Yeah. So, I'll take part two if you take part one.
Okay, I'll take part one. part one is, do we give ammunition to the enemy, whoever the enemy is? There are a couple of vexatious opponents of Clue Train, we might say, that insist that what we actually wrote was a marketing book, and that we are part of the marketing sphere, and it didn't matter if we were marketers or defected from marketing, we in fact gave more ammunition to the enemy, as it were. I don't think that's true. I think that the BS detection that we have is better than ever, and if marketers want to continue to send messages at us and they want to say they're Clue Training messages, that doesn't mean that Clue Train's to blame for that. It means that they didn't understand it, and so I'm not too concerned about that.
One of the ways of reading, to your second point, of reading the history of the internet, especially of the web, is as a series of continuous innovation in how we're going to sort and filter what we want. Because it keeps scaling up more and more, hundreds of billions and more coming in. And we still keep managing, because we have to, we keep managing to invent new ways to help us try to find what it is that we need and what we want to see. And so we have too many blogs. So Dave Weiner comes up with RSS. And that gets refined. And there are too many tweets. And so, there's a natural mechanism of following people. You can control your list, but still too many, so now we get...
So for every base of the pyramid, there's some form of filter
that comes out
in the wash.
Yes, and one of the most interesting ways that we've been doing it is, in fact, I think quite a, if I may say so, Clue Training way. A lot of these innovations use social filtering, use our friends and their conversations and their stuff.
Dig.
Dig is,
But for every dig, is there a subvertandprofit.com, which I think is still up and running, Becca, where subvertandprofit.com, this is the weirdest shout out to give. It's
like, spell it out.
I guess. Talk about, solace to the enemy. Subvertandprofit.com, which allows you to tap into the black market of votes on social media sites, and it's one social media participant at a time who's willing to take a buck to dig something random, in addition to all the regular stuff that she digs. And Subvert and Profit takes another buck, so it's $2 per dig. Does that worry you, or you think that'll be outed, or are we going to get into the rotten hell zone again?
Exactly. It is the rotten hell zone. We need a special circle. I think that it will always be the case that we are going to have bad actors who are using the openness of the net in order to their slimy advantage, Because the alternative is that we shut it down, we have strict authentication schemes, you do have to take a test before you get on it, you turn off the generativity of your devices. This is, I now owe you a nickel because this is clearly your term. So I hope that we actually are in a position where people can always game this stuff, because the alternative is the lockdown.
I don't want to add that I think to me there's something wonderful that there are so many ways to not have a life. that's sort of what goes on with that. I mean, if you sell out that cheap, I'm amused by that. I mean,
but systemically speaking,
it's yeah. Like, so we had television before, and we were all somatized staring at a rectangle. You know, so you know now we're. I think many more people are being productive than ever before, and there are a lot of people who have found more active ways to be unproductive. So what?
Got it.
I wanted to add, so...
Yes, sir.
Because I've been watching Shava over here type questions up here on a phone in a Hutton Peck way, and she's had long questions. I wanted to address her at some point. Just like, I want to have mercy.
Well, the time is now.
We share a birthday.
And I just want to say, if you folks had any sense of humor, the number one question here would be about legalizing marijuana.
That's so last week.
So did you want to give Jeffrey Seil the answer before she asked the question, or did you want to have Shava ask the question?
There we go. Sensing participation was a phrase you used. And during the Dean campaign, where I was a key volunteer in Oregon at the time, and working with them, getting them online tools like training videos and things like that, my arch nemesis in terms of participation was, oddly enough, MoveOn. Because MoveOn was circulating all of these things that were web petitions, which basically sat there and said, come to this website, sign this web petition, which we won't really send anywhere, and by the way, give us money. And people went, they signed the petition, they gave a donation to MoveOn, they got a sticker, and they never got off their butts and out on the street. So in terms of sensing participation, is that like the shadow of...
They always wanted it to be a, quote, shoe-leather and mousepad campaign with the aim of using the online to stir up enthusiasm, but in order to get you offline to the street doing the work that has to be done door-to-door, and that they feel that they were not successful at that. I think this is absolutely one of the lessons that the Obama campaign learned, and they did that very, as you say, they did that very, very well.
And in fact, the Oregon campaign had the best shoe-leather in the entire country. Because we decided that we were going to pretend we were a nonprofit instead of a political party.
You know, I won't Mirandize you here, but statutes of limitations, well, anyway.
Yeah, say no more is what I'm trying to say. She was not in violation.
Oh, okay, good.
There is this broader question of whether, forgetting the politics for the moment, whether online interactions are worse than real world, and so by spending time online, we're depriving ourselves of actual face-to-face and real.
Yes.
And I'd be interested in seeing data about that. My sense is, my own personal one data point, which is worth nothing, is that I have no friends, I never did, in the real world. I have a richly satisfying social life. Man is in
so you're
the
saying
online
the Kluge
world,
manifesto was a cry for help.
How pathetic is that?
The online sex is awesome.
Yeah.
It's fascinating.
I think there's a difference between politics and governance, between a campaign and a government. And we've seen that in Massachusetts with Deval Patrick running a very, very good campaign for governor using Netroots and Grassroots in a way that wasn't really seen before on a state level. And then Obama doing the same thing. But both of them are not governing the same way. They're not governing. Deval Patrick has become irrelevant in this state, by and large. And Obama is not mobilizing the 13 million people that he had on his mailing list and still has in order to push through his programs in any kind of way that I can see. And I think you get locked into that particular bubble, and it becomes very difficult.
Yeah.
And there may be something also there in terms of open source and what's happening with hardware and software in relationship to corporations. I mean, I think the next stage will be to govern the way that Dean, Patrick, Obama ran. which becomes an entirely different exercise. And I think manufacturing in terms of open source and craft-based, all of the old kinds of things that you're talking about, which are now digitized and ephemeralized and dematerialized around the world.
Okay. I agree with everything you just said, with a single exception of the answer to Jay-Z's question about why, which is power. I think that it's easy for a campaign to work out the problems that the Obama campaign worked out, especially since there were tracks already in the snow from the Dean campaign 4 years before. I think solving governance is a much, much harder thing. It's a really, really big challenge. The entrenched bureaucracies are enormous. The opposition in the form of the entire Beltway business system and the way it works, the way goods are procured by government, for example, is very, very complex. It's regulatorily beyond complex in many ways. I think it's much bigger problems to solve. That's not about Massachusetts. That's actually at the federal level. But I imagine the same thing applies here, even if Deval Patrick is being lame in some ways as a governor. I think solving the governance problem the same way is difficult.
I was going to say, it may also raise the question just of innately whether the toolkit you'd want as a challenger, as an insurgent, as somebody that doesn't have easy access to the broader media, may be a different one than once you happen to have been given the ticker tape parade and you've got other mechanisms or other responsibilities to what you're doing. I don't know if that translates into the business space, too. But Phil? Yeah.
In fact, Doc and Joyce were at our home and 6 years ago last month, when we suddenly agreed, wow, a president who needs the internet to get reelected has got to be our guy. And so I embedded myself in the Howard Dean campaign for a week a month, last half of 2003, and learned a lot. The answer to your question is that these campaigns are run, remember the first video transmission things where the guys are on the roller skates, they go and they get a deck, they put a tape on the deck and they run over and do this. You remember that? That's how it was actually done in the first days. Back in Bell South was doing that. That's how the campaigns are run. They don't have a platform. They don't have a web services platform. They have 45 really smart young people working literally around the clock. And if you were paying those people, it would be a budget that no organization would do. Hallie Suit and I had dinner just 2 days before Christmas in 2003. It was a Saturday night. And Hallie said, I guess all the kids are gone home. So I said, let's stop by. There were 45 people working at 11 o'clock on Saturday before Christmas, okay? They had to be there because they had 17 disparate databases. Everything was done manually. You had to have 5 people there all the time.
Now, is this a loving story of passionate kids fighting for what they like, or is it a modern-day sweatshop in which they're being given literally peanuts for their work?
Both. Uh-huh. But the reason is that there's a lot of money, there's a lot of romance around a presidential campaign. Notice that only a presidential campaign has so far been able to arrange this kind of thing.
You don't think the open source movement or the free software movement would claim that that's the kind of passion that they get when somebody stays up all night trying to solve that last obscure and irrelevant bug?
Right. But until we give them a platform, that is a web services platform that's soup to nuts, it's not going to happen because the government can't build it. I would submit the government shouldn't even own it because the next administration is going to shut it down. I believe it's actually an easy problem that looks hard. I think it's a GRM, which is the sort of shadow project I've been pushing on with Doc.
Government
relationship management.
Where you put out a bid for the government you want, and the government bid, and it's like, woohoo, Antigua.
Well, not at all. government looks hard to people. Government looks hard to people because detailed organization is always hard. Running government is probably easier than running GE.
Yeah.
Okay. But GE, we think we know how that works. We don't.
Yeah.
All right. The fact is that government has a proxy battle in every department of the operation every 2, 4, 6 years. And when somebody leaves, the whole staff leaves. The whole government's a very easy problem, but we have to have a platform that is campaign-oriented, because everything that happens in government is a result of a campaign. We can use these same things.
Yeah.
The other thing to remember in a presidential campaign is you choose your web services platform real early before you have money.
Yeah.
And you can't change it then.
Yeah.
You're stuck. All right. The same thing happened with the Obama campaign. We know the pedigree of the Obama campaign, of that platform that came from blue states. Now, they spent millions running around on the roller skates, you know, plugging things in to keep it running. But they couldn't really rebuild the platform in the middle of the campaign.
Yeah.
All right. So until we actually build that platform, build a web services platform, purpose-built, which is actually quite straightforward, not technically, it's not cheap, but that's part of the problem.
Got it.
So I want to put in just one brief marker. I will not bore you or the crowd. I think there's actually a really interesting and encouraging set of initiatives by the Obama administration that should make people who love the web happy, and I would release hopeful. So I would not put him exactly in the same category as our governor.
But I actually fortuitously ran across yesterday's copy of the Financial Times on my way home yesterday on the T, and inside there was a section entitled The Business of Luxury, and inside that there was a wonderful thing, which I will just read from very briefly. And there was an interview with the chairman of Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy Louis Vuitton, and so he says, "The internet is more and more important for both communication and how we manage our company internally. I have instant access to real time to my stores around the world. Young people seem to like the internet. We feel it is a customer service to sell products online, and it is the greatest risk to this industry moving forward." Talks about fake products being a problem for them, and then he says, "We have to find some way to put morality online. After all, this is one of the fastest growing areas of tomorrow's economy." So this is 15 or so odd years after the web has been around.
Send that man a book.
10 years after the Clue Train has left the station. And this guy seems
like the internet.
Well, yeah, so what he's realized is the internet seems to be a big thing. Young people seem to like it. We should really sell online, and the reporter failed to pick up that in fact they're shutting down their online store on the 26th of this month, and they didn't mention that. That's how clued in they are. So my question is this: what on earth is it going to take?
Well, failure,
failure is a very good remedy for this.
Well, actually, no, they talked about failure in here. I mean, this guy has successfully steered the company through 9/11, thanks, Ben. 9/11, SARS, and, I mean, this company's been around for a long time. They have probably capital reserves to fail a lot of times.
What can you say? I mean, is there a complete lack of vision and understanding? Undoubtedly, there are hundreds of people in his own organization who are reading that and going, stop saying that, and they're, you know, this guy just has to basically probably go away one way or another. I mean, it's nothing magical.
Yeah, I mean, the net's a habitat. You know, some are going to survive, some aren't. You know, you're doing very well, and that's awesome. You know, so to me, what you're doing and what other, you know, smart people who actually get the net are doing is more important than what, you know, failures like that are doing. So,
to follow up on that question, could you give examples of companies that you think get it, that in the intervening 10 years have figured out and gotten on the Clue Train?
And if you could make them stock picks, that would be particularly welcome.
Part of the problem is, I think, with that company now is a laughable exception. And so all companies, to one degree or another, almost all companies, have some sense of this. The fact that on retail sites you now routinely find product reviews uncensored from customers is completely counter to the previous 100 years of business thinking. And now it's just, of course you're going to. Because if you don't, they'll go somewhere else, and it's good for people to be happy with what they buy. And that single thing to me is an indicator of just how far businesses have come. They haven't come far enough. The fact that IBM, so here's an iconic example. You know, IBM is the company that for a generation, actually a couple generations, defined the conservative business approach, the top-down command and control system, everybody dressed alike. That's how controlling it was. It was the icon of that era. And now it's doing the jams, IBM jams. In fact, they're franchising jams to other companies where everybody in the company, 400,000 people, get to talk for 3 days over the web. Everybody's equal, your position doesn't matter, and you get to all have a values jam.
Wait, and this is good? It sounds like you think these jams are goofy.
I think it's good. the fact that that a company like that has stopped developing their own web server in order because they took up Apache instead. You know, they went open source and they contribute to open source. This is IBM. This is a change in their business model, as well as their culture. Is astounding and unpredictable, and a sign of how deep the change is. Is IBM the perfect example of no? But that's pretty good stuff.
I think that the book, in fact, did change the way we thought about business. Many people thought about business, and gave us a lot of energy to create some new businesses and try new things. In 1999, was that right? Is that when? And I think here we are in 2009. And I'd love to hear what you guys think, or in even better, here you're going to do a book to help us all start more businesses and get this absolutely deadbeat economy going and kind of kick us all in the entrepreneurial pants, so to speak. And are you thinking about that? We're all going to buy the book today, of course. But what's your next book to get us going? We need some help.
More immediately or shorter term, a shorter businessy book on the nature of expertise and expertise taking on the properties of networks manifesto.
So, I mean, this also leads to a Barbara Walters style question, which is clearly part of your ethos is how to enter into a conversation. And the reason why it's so hard often for the standard canonical business you're talking about is because they hear things they don't want to hear. They worked right. So long on this product and people might not like it. And that could be true, certainly, of a book produced by people. How do you handle the negative stuff? Is there a way that you would actually want to foreground that on the website and actually have the most negative blurbs juxtaposed with the best ones in the interest of truth and authenticity?
I like to engage them. I mean, when I see a critic who's actually got something substantive to say, I like to, you know, call them out and talk to them about it rather than say, you're wrong about that, but rather see, you know,
and do you
probe
have
it a
comments
little bit.
On your site? I mean, does your site have a blog with comments?
The ClueTrade itself does not. We just kind of declared it. We had a part of it where people could just sort of post comments.
It was
a
free
blog.
It was a
free
blog.
ClueTrade.
Yeah, but most of it did.
We
don't
have
I mean,
active blogs with active comments.
Got it. And do you moderate those comments?
No.
Yes. A lot of if it's a spammer or something, you know, I mean, some spammers get through the filter, and they're not saying anything. They're trying to game Google AdSense or something like that.
Got
those
it.
I get rid of. If it's something negative, or critical, I generally always let it through. It's not an issue, and so yeah.
The book I wrote after this, one of the reviewers said that it was as if written by a room full of monkeys, but not as good.
Which the right answer is just wait. I was going to ask either or both of you, as people who are almost constantly thinking about this stuff and immersed in it, what do you see as the questions on your minds right now? Along these lines, that remains unanswered. It's a really kind of interesting, pressing question. And see if there are thoughts among the people here about the question before we part. I don't know if either of you wants to put a question out there.
Well, here's one, and it's a structural one, and it actually addresses the digital divide to some degree because there are many, many, many more mobile phones in the world than there are internet connections.
Yeah.
Something I learned from Dr. Zuckerman over here, and the question is, when does the phone system become a data system and not just a phone system? I think it has to do that. I think that's where we're going to head with it. I think when do cable systems become a data system? In infrastructure, I think is a really big open question. How do we make, you know, how do we get as close to everybody networked as possible? So that's, and I don't know what answer to that.
Are you confident that when that happens, the result of the convergence of the peanut butter and the chocolate will actually be a delicious treat, will be that essence of internet that you think the manifesto represents, rather than at some point the ethos of cable television or standard mobile phones will actually take over?
I'm a utopian on that one. I think, and it's not because I think the net is a panacea, though I think it has wonderful qualities to it. It's because I think human beings are terribly resourceful.
Yeah.
I think people are extraordinarily resourceful. And if they have the tools to be more resourceful with, they're going to do creative things with it.
Yeah.
And I think that the ability of anybody to connect with anybody and do anything undermines, I mean, hyperlinks subvert hierarchy. I think resourcefulness by anybody subverts hierarchy and actually allows us to create better ones.
We're better off than we were just a few months ago, but I do worry a great deal about the attractiveness in many ways of locked down, non-generative devices like, you know, the iPhone and the next generation of Apple stuff up from the iPhone, where they decide the App Store is actually a pretty good model, and so because it makes customers, consumers really happy because the stuff is safe, and so we go to an App Store model and we get locked down computers. It's not at all, a lot of movement in the international level as well as is exactly, from my point of view, in the wrong direction. So I remain basically a utopian who's still scared shitless.
Could you speak about China? That was one thing that scared me shitless, was the anniversary of Tiananmen Square, where the whole collective memory of what had happened was almost erased, depending on whose account you believe.
Well, it's basically
despite all this technology that's supposed to be able to link people together, but they were able to find technological ways to subvert people from connecting in the way that you guys seem to think is inevitable.
So one of the things that I believe 10 years ago, I was more of a John Perry Barlow, the internet routes around obstacles sort of person. And over the past, well, I'll say at least 5 years, I am much less convinced of that. China is one very good proof point. And so maybe if you're enough of a hacker in China, you can manage to do the uplink and get your, but as a cultural thing, no, you can lock down the internet. There's been a lot of research done, really wonderful research done at the Berkman Center on exactly this question, and it's hard to remain, it's hard for me to maintain my belief that the internet will always route around when we have so many instances in which, for most people, no, it can be locked down. So I think China is scary in itself and a proof point and should get us working even harder to make sure that our internet stays free. Where our, by the way, doesn't mean American versus Chinese. I mean, the internet is ours. So,
from a consumer perspective, and I know there are a lot of people who do digital native studies in here, I'm curious if there'll be a little bit of a convergence between clueful companies and an upcoming generation that maybe won't tolerate the kind of lockdown technology that we seem to fall into so easily, but maybe there'll be a different notion about what needs to be unlocked in the future with the upcoming generation. I'm just wondering if maybe there's some hope for utopia in the kids behind us.
Yes, and I actually think there's plenty of hope for utopia. Absolutely, I remain utopian and more hopeful than ever, in part because of much of what I see happening in the new administration in the U.S. And I think you're absolutely right. I think the generational change that's going on, and it will take a full generation for that to happen. You know, Doc and I have to die.
No rush. Before no rush.
But no, you can stick around and be the senior elder statespeople of the movement that has a certain voice to it. Whether or not the kids today have that voice, I don't know. We have some experts on digital natives
but
here.
I'd like to answer to finish answering that question, though, because I'm actually very optimistic about that. I think that they're, in the long run, locking down is not a great strategy, and I think it's going to fail in too many cases. I think right now we're still at a time when it still pays off enough, but that's going to change, and I think it's going to change as individuals get more power. I think as individuals have the power to say, you know what, these are my terms of engagement. I don't want to sign your lousy one-sided privacy agreement. That's one of the things we're working on. You know, what are the terms of engagement that we bring to the table? They're going to be better than the coercive ones that you're hitting us with, because you don't trust us, and that distrust is counterproductive. I mean, I think that, you know, the Apple App Store is slick and the rest of it, but it can't scale, right? We're seeing these all the time, where they're rejecting one program or another over some specious grounds, and you know, why have a sphincter, why sphincter everything? You know, that's kind of the way they do it. But it's interesting to me that, you know, companies will talk an open game and play a closed one. It's annoying to me that the and discouraging that instant messaging, for example, that the Jabber protocol XMPP has not been widely enough adopted when that's the answer to everybody having, you know, a different IM. Microsoft and Yahoo and Apple all have different IM systems even today. You know, why should Yahoo have a proprietary IM system? It makes no sense. But that's self-defeating on their part, and it's going to be proven wrong. I just think that it's going to fail in the long run. So
we end with predictions having to do with open and close and top-down and bottom-up and whether or not we can trust the kids any more than ourselves, as we did 10 years ago.
Kind of have to.
It'll be fascinating to check in 10 years from now and see what it would even mean to check in. 10 years from now, does that mean we'd all show up in an amphitheater-like room with a screen behind us, or we finally have those Minority Report weird holodeck thingies? I think not. That's my prediction, and you can take that to the offshore Icelandic bank. So with that, I think we owe our guests a huge round of applause.